The number of birders has increased 230% since the mid-1980s, making birding one of the fastest-growing forms of outdoor recreation. A new book called Of a Feather, A Brief History of Birding in America, traces the history of birding in this country, highlighting the colorful figures who helped transform an exotic hobby into a widespread passion. Its author is Scott Wiedensahl, who says he's been obsessed with birds all of his life and is a federally licensed bird bander. I'm very pleased to welcome him to the show. Hi.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Did you recognize the bird song we opened with?
I sure did. It was a black-capped chickadee singing there. Phoebe, Phoebe, Phoebe.
I would not have known that in a billion years. Must one be able to recognize a wide range of bird songs to be taken seriously as a birder?
I suppose so, but I mean, it adds to the enjoyment of it because a lot of birding is by ear. You walk out on a spring morning and you hear this rush of bird song, and the birds are all hidden up in the trees, but the songs come pouring through, and you can hear them well. But you don't have to be obsessed. You don't have to be passionate. You don't have to be knowledgeable about birds in order to enjoy birds. Just mm-hmm. being outside and seeing them, even if you can't put a name to them, is a lot of fun in that as well.
Well, most people think of birding as this thing that's done with binoculars, but obviously it's also done with your ears.
Yeah, actually, the really good birders have exceptionally sharp hearing. You can always make up for bad eyesight with a pair of binoculars, but if you're like me and you have a bad sense of hearing, there's only so much you can do with things like hearing aids.
Now, your book is A Brief History of Birding in America. Does birding precede Columbus coming to America?
Well, I mean, we had a native culture spread across this continent for tens of thousands of years that undoubtedly had a rich store of ornithological wisdom of their own, almost all of which is gone, unfortunately, after the Europeans got here. And
they didn't share it with the Europeans?
Well, they did in some cases. I mean, the Hopi in the Southwest told early American ornithologists that the bird that we know is the poor will, it's a relative of the nighthawk and the whippoorwill, that it hibernates. In fact, the Hopi name for it means sleeping one. Well, everybody knows that birds don't hibernate. I mean, frogs do and snakes do, but birds don't. And then in the 1940s, they discovered that, sure enough, poor wills do hibernate under certain circumstances. So, they tried to tell us, but we just didn't really listen.
But there must have been birding in Europe way before the Europeans came here.
There was, but it wasn't birding as recreation. There was the science of birds. And this, the subtitle of the book is a little misleading because, birding, nobody picks up a pair of binoculars for the first two-thirds of the book. I mean, up to that point, it's all shotgun ornithology. You just study birds. You had to shoot birds. And that was the case in Europe as well. But people have been fascinated by birds as long as we've been human. The very first example of artwork comes from a cave in France more than 30,000 years old. And among the images in that cave is an owl that somebody scratched in mud on the side of the cave wall. So it's something that goes back a long way.
And humans fantasize flying, Leonardo coming up with bird-like wings.
Absolutely.
So that we could glide. Most historical writing on ornithology begins in 19th century Philadelphia with Alexander Wilson and John James Audubon. But you take the story much further back. When did Europeans first start to pay serious attention to birds?
Well, it's interesting because when you look at the very first records of Europeans exploring along the Atlantic seaboard, I mean, these were not people with any scientific or recreational interest in birds. I mean, they were interested in shooting them and eating them, but they were mostly looking for gold and slaves and land. And yet, over and over again in their accounts, you get this awestruck recollections of the numbers and diversity of birds here in the East. I mean, think about it. What it must have been like for a European to see a flock of passenger pigeons with 2 billion birds in it a river of birds a mile wide that took 3 or 4 days to pass by a spot. I mean, it was absolutely staggering for these people.
A lot more birds than are around today.
There are. There's no question. I mean, what spring migration must have been like in the 1700s when people like Mark Catesby and a century later, you had Alexander Wilson coming over from Scotland and landing in spring along the coast in Delaware and walking to Philadelphia and seeing all of these birds, in colors and diversity that he'd never even imagined back there in the lonely moors of Scotland.
Even before Mark Catesby, there was John White and then John Lawson.
Lawson's an interesting guy. He was the Surveyor General for the Carolina colonies in the very early 1700s. And he wrote the first account, really, of the natural history of the Carolinas, including what birders today would call an annotated checklist, a list of about 136 species of birds with a short description of their habits and when they came through Carolina. And he was about to write a much more comprehensive description of the natural history of the Carolinas, but he was the surveyor general, which meant he was giving away the land of the Tuscarora Indians to settlers. And when the Tuscarora War started, he was executed by the Tuscarora. So Catesby came over a few years later from England and took his work and expanded on it greatly.
And Catesby claimed that he painted every species of bird. That's got to be impossible.
No, he claimed that he'd seen about 110 species, and that was all there was. But, you know, this was a guy who had no optics. He didn't have binoculars. He didn't have cameras. If you're a birder, think about how many of those birds that we see in the spring and fall migration that are way up in the treetops. You only identify them by sound because they're 100 or 150 feet off the ground. It's no wonder that Catesby overlooked so many of them.
But he seems like a remarkable man. Didn't he come up with an early form of the theory of continental drift?
This is the most amazing thing when you read Catesby's work. He was speculating on why there are certain species of birds that are found on both sides of the Atlantic. And you know, he talks about, you know, understanding, of course, that all of these birds came out of Noah's Ark at the end of the flood. But then he makes this remarkable speculation that perhaps they had crossed the vast Atlantic, with a K on the end, as he said, at a time when the two continents were much closer together than they are today. Which, when you consider that, you know, he had just moments before, you know, talked about his faith in the biblical flood, and one would assume that he thought the earth was only about 6,000 years old. And this, you know, this predates the theory of continental drift by about 200 years. And that's the only thing, it was this one paragraph, it's the only thing he wrote about it.
Well, he obviously had an insight, a scientific insight, yeah. And we don't know whether he really believed in the literal interpretation of the Bible. After all, yeah. A lot of people were worried that if they questioned that, they would get in trouble at the time.
That's right.
There are other people that most of us haven't heard of. William Bartram is one of them.
Bartram was an interesting guy as well. His father, John Bartram, was a self-taught botanist in Philadelphia in the early 1700s, became one of the most famous botanists in the world. And so Billy Bartram, as a young man, followed his father on these collecting expeditions up and down the eastern seaboard. But he kind of drifted through life. His father tried to set him up as an apprentice with Ben Franklin, and he turned him down. He failed in a number of business ventures. And then when he was in his 30s, in the 1770s, he set off on a multi-year expedition down through the southern Appalachians and Florida and around the Gulf Coast, and published a book that came out in the 1880s. It's still one of the most engaging and readable accounts of frontier exploration. He identified many new species of plants, many new species of birds that had never been seen before. And then he retired. He almost died a couple of times on this trip, and he retired to his father's estate in Philadelphia and lived out the rest of his life there. And people like Washington and Jefferson, you know, beat a path to his door. And then one day, this young, kind of scruffy, scrawny-looking guy with a Scottish brogue shows up at his doorstep and introduces himself as the new school teacher down the river at Gray's Ferry. And I suspect that Bartram may have seen a little bit of himself in this young man who had left Scotland under a cloud. He was a convicted blackmailer, was a failed poet. And this young man's name was Alexander Wilson, and he wanted to write the first comprehensive ornithology, the first comprehensive account of scientific account of the birds of the New World.
And earning him the title Father of American Ornithology.
That's right.
Although, obviously, he's not the father. He is one of the early people.
Right, but he's certainly respected among ornithologists for the first time taking all of this information and compiling it in a scientific fashion. Even though when he arrived here, he didn't know what any of the birds were. He had to teach himself how to draw and to etch those paintings into copper plates so he could illustrate his book. Bartram helped him a great deal with that. And he would send these paintings back to Bartram and say, you know, be so kind as to indicate the names of each, because except for three or four of them, I don't know what they are. And yet this is a guy a year after he had announced that he was going to write this monumental work of scientific ornithology.
My guest is Scott Wydenstahl, who's written a book called Of a Feather, A Brief History of American Birding, published by Harcourt. They all seem to know each other because John James Audubon knew Wilson.
Yes, although it was interesting, when they both lived in Philadelphia, they never crossed paths. It wasn't until years later, Audubon was failing miserably as a shopkeeper in Louisville, Kentucky, and Wilson was in the process of publishing his book, and he needed to find subscribers to it. So he would actually travel up and down the United States selling subscriptions, and he was in Louisville, and he almost sold a subscription to Audubon. Audubon was about to sign on the dotted line. Wilson didn't know who this guy was. And Audubon's business partner came in and said something to him under his breath in French, and said, you know, "My dear Audubon, why are you buying this book? Your paintings are so much better." At least that's what Audubon said.
He was a self-mythologizer.
He certainly was. You've got to take everything Audubon says with a grain of salt. In all likelihood, that meeting in 1811 was what gave Audubon the idea of doing this monumental Birds of America that he spent much of the rest of his life working on.
And he did paint a lot better.
He did. He did. There's no question that Audubon was a superior artist.
Also important roles in this story are played by Lewis and Clark. We don't normally associate them with birding.
No, we don't. Lewis and Clark were really the first military expedition into the West that paid attention to science. Now, neither of these two Army officers were scientists, but Thomas Jefferson sent Lewis to Philadelphia for a crash course in medicine and the natural sciences before they went on that trip, because he knew that, you know, of course, you know, Jefferson was an amateur scientist. He was actually quite an avid bird watcher. He knew that they were going to be encountering new species, and he wanted these men to be able to record them scientifically. And so, you know, today when you travel through the West, you may see Lewis's woodpecker, Clark's nutcracker. Many of these bird specimens were sent back to Philadelphia, and Alexander Wilson described them for science for the first time in his American Ornithology.
And then the American military went out into the West, and there were people who were interested in birds in that group as well.
Well, that's right. I mean, if you wanted to do ornithology or science of any sort in the West during the frontier period, the only safe way to do it was from the protection of an army column, a cavalry column. And Spencer Baird, who was the founder of the National Museum of Natural History in Washington, his father-in-law was the inspector general of the army. So he could ask his father-in-law to post army surgeons and officers with an interest in natural history wherever Baird wanted them in the West, so that they could collect specimens and send them back to the Smithsonian. And so you had people like Charles Bender, or Bendire as his name is often pronounced, who was an army officer in the 1870s in Arizona, discovered the first time anybody had discovered the nest of a rare hawk called the zone-tailed hawk.
He had the egg in his mouth.
That's the one. He climbed up the tree, was about to pocket the eggs, and realized that the Apache were closing in on him. So he popped this egg in his mouth and, you know, rode for miles back to camp with the Apache in hot pursuit with this egg still clutched in his mouth. And the egg is still in the Smithsonian today.
So up until this point, we're really talking about individuals doing something. But then we have a major change. We have the Audubon Society created.
That's right. And it really grew out of a shock at the terrible state that bird populations were in the late 1800s. Birds were being slaughtered every year by the hundreds of millions for the millinery trade to put feathers on women's hats. They were being slaughtered for the market. There was an attempt in the 1880s to start an Audubon Society that failed. And it wasn't until the 1890s that a group of society women in Boston started the second coming of the Audubon movement, and was incredibly successful because they were able to tap into the women's club movement across the country, where women were fighting for suffrage and fighting for temperance and against poverty. And they were able to say to these women, you know, if you seek the high moral ground on these other issues, then you ladies should not wear the feathers of slaughtered innocence on their hats.
But still, a lot had to be learned, and that continued into the 20th century. We have all of these names that contend with David Sibley, Kent Kaufman, Roger Torrey Peterson.
And by that point, what you're talking about is not ornithology as in terms of the science of birds. You're talking about birding in terms of the recreation of birds. Birding, particularly with the publication of Peterson's first field guide in the 1930s, made birds accessible to the average person. It was no longer a case of a scientist going out with a shotgun, shooting a bird, and then identifying it in the hand. With binoculars, with a field guide, anybody could go out into Central Park on a spring morning, see a bird flitting in the treetops, be able to identify it. And so you had this explosive growth in birding, particularly after World War II.
Because Audubon had to kill the bird to be able to paint it.
Well, sure. And it was through no fault of his own, of course.
Now, should we make distinctions between bird watcher and birder?
I think most serious birders do. Bird watcher has sort of this fussy, stuffy, little old ladies in tennis shoes connotation to it, which I think is unfortunate because birding today has become very competitive. It's become very list-focused. People who keep life lists.
They're called listers, aren't they?
Or tickers or twitchers over in the UK. Well, there's a lot of birders who are fairly listless as well. I mean, I keep a life list because it's fun to record what birds you've seen, but I couldn't tell you within 100 species what's on my life list. I really find the sense of bird watching much more rewarding. The idea of studying the birds, learning more about their behavior, their ecology. And it's the sort of thing that, because there's this long history of amateurs making contributions to the science of birds, that continues today. We have, you know, millions of birders across the country that are involved in projects like Project Feeder Watch through the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, the Great Backyard Bird Count. You can go out, have fun, record your bird sightings, and that all goes into a database that allows scientists to help understand and manage birds and preserve them for the future.
Have we been seeing changes as a result of global warming?
We've been seeing dramatic changes. Species of birds like mockingbirds and cardinals that have been slowly moving north over the last century are moving north further and further and faster and faster. Species like red-bellied woodpeckers that were once primarily a southern and mid-Atlantic state species are all the way up in the Canadian Maritimes now. We're seeing shifts in populations, breeding populations across the Arctic, where global warming is having its most dramatic effects right now. And birders and scientists are scrambling to try to monitor this so we can both document what's happening and also try to predict. You know, we've set up this network, for example, of national wildlife refuges across the country. As climate change kicks in, some of the species that those refuges were set up to protect may not be there anymore.
What about the birds that have been able to adjust to city life, like pale male, the red-tailed hawk that lives in a building near Central Park? We've had falcons on some of our skyscrapers. Are they just adjusting to the changes of the world?
They are. I was watching pale male this morning, but I was also watching Cooper's hawks hunting at the bird feeders in the Ramble in Central Park. And these are birds that 30 years ago you would not have found in urban areas. You mentioned peregrine falcons. There are wild turkeys on the island of Manhattan today. That even 15 years ago, that would have been laughable. Ravens, which a century ago were wilderness species, I saw ravens along I-78 in New Jersey, not far from Newark, a couple of weeks ago. So these are birds that are adapting well to us. But there are many other species of birds that are not able to adapt to the kind of habitat changes that we've been imposing on the landscape.
Scott Wiedenthal is the author of many books of natural history, including Return to Wild America, The Ghost with Trembling Wings, the Pulitzer Prize finalist Living on the Wind, and also Mountains of the Heart. His most recent book is Of a Feather, A Brief History of American Birding, published by Harcourt. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a real pleasure.